For years, my family and I have enjoyed vacationing in the Smoky Mountains. At times, over the years, we visited some of the waterfalls, hiked up to wherever they were. Probably our favorite waterfall was Laurel Falls. Any of you been to Laurel Falls? Quite a number of folks. It's got a paved path, so it's a nice one to hike up to. I understand they did that because of erosion. They kept washing away the hiking paths. They finally paved it. A number of years ago, been back in the mid-90s, Brittany and I hiked a mile and a half or whatever it is up to Laurel Falls. Now, Laurel Falls comes over the top here and falls down to a kind of a landing area. And there's pools of water right in here. And then just beyond this bridge here, there's another drop-off. It's a sheer drop-off into another big pool of water down below. The last time I was there, this bridge, this walkway was not there. So you were exposed to the second drop if you didn't watch what you were doing. There's plenty of room. And on this particular day, I had entered into that area where the falls had come over kind of back here and kind of washed into these pools. And, you know, I kind of tiptoed across the rocks. And all the people that were there, there was probably 30 people there at least. And many of the young people and a number of the adults, as they always do, had taken off their shoes, was over there wading around in the water. And I didn't care to wade, and I didn't take my shoes off. I think Brittany was wading, and she wasn't very old at the time. And I was kind of standing over here just watching what was going on. And there were some people came in, and a youngster about, I guess, him 8 or 9. He comes over, and he's all excited about wading. And so he begins to take his sneakers off. Now, you know how young people take their sneakers off. And I'm going to have a difficult time mimicking this morning. But, you know, it's like this. And he's trying to pull his sneaker off, and he's jumping on one leg like this. And as he jumps, he goes like this. I swear to you, he was within 6 inches of dropping straight down. And I'm standing over here, I'm like, by the time I notice him, I'm afraid to say anything because I'm afraid he will then make do fall over the side. And his parents are totally oblivious to it. And I'm just like in shock. And finally he gets his shoe off and off he goes. And I don't think he ever had a clue how close he was. This is an 80-foot falls. And the top part looks like maybe not quite half of it. So I'm saying another 40 or 50 feet onto the rocks below. I want to use that little instant because I want you to picture something in your mind that I think is comparable to the Christian life for far, far too many of us. We are so focused on just having a good time, like the tourists, all excited about wading in the pool, oblivious sometimes to the danger that's so close. You're so often we are focused on, what makes us happy, what pleases us, what we enjoy, the good things in life. And everything is going well, and we are really, truly oblivious to the danger that is always there one step away. I'm not trying to make you paranoid or anything like that. I've known of some Christian people that did get a little bit overly concerned about the dangers of this world to the point they wouldn't hardly leave home. And I've heard of churches that would go around, and charismatic churches, I'm not trying to make fun of, just what they did up in the mountains where I came from. They anointed everything with oil. And they even anointed the doorknobs of the church so evil people wouldn't come in. I'm not trying to make you some sort of paranoid religious nut this morning. Our problem is on the other end of the spectrum. We don't have enough serious thought about the dangers that lurk about us in the spiritual life. We're hopping around on one foot that close to spiritual disaster half the time, and we do not even know it. 1 Peter chapter 5, and we're not preaching there, but I want to remind you that in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8, Peter warns, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour." Now, I know that's a metaphor there. Satan isn't going to literally devour us, but he will do everything he can within his power and discretion to destroy our lives. No, he cannot rob us of our salvation if we're truly born again, but he can ruin our lives. He can ruin our testimony. He can take away our joy. And he can even destroy us physically if we're not careful. A.W. Tozer many years ago wrote this, and I think it is so true today. More true, no doubt, than when he wrote it. He said this, that the world is a playground instead of a battleground has now been accepted in practice by the vast majority of Christians. We are too often oblivious to the fact that we live and exist in a battleground. There is a battle going on. An unconcerned, unaware attitude, spiritually speaking, will leave us more vulnerable than we could ever be otherwise. But Satan's methods, the things that he does, all that he orchestrates, they're not readily apparent. Think of that roaring lion. The lion roars to mark his territory. He doesn't roar when he's hunting. It's just descriptive of the male lion there in that verse. But when a lion is hunting, he hunts silently and stealthily. And there is always temptation on the horizon. I don't care who we are. We don't somehow gain a level of spirituality that frees us from temptation. That'll never happen until the Lord comes back and we have a new body. Temptation is always on the horizon, and it's not always evident. So we need to have a very sober approach to the topic at hand. Since temptation is always there, always one step away, we need to become aware of some specific dangers, some specific situations or circumstances that we may happen upon or find ourselves in that will alert us to the danger that is before us. And we're going to do this by turning to the 33rd chapter of the book of Genesis. Chapter 33 and verse 17. And Jacob journeyed to Succoth, built himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore the name of the place is called Succoth. Then Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. When he came from Padan Aram, and he pitched his tent before the city, and he bought a parcel of land where he had pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And he erected an altar there and called it El Elohim Israel. Let me refresh your memory, because it's been a while since we left off at this point in the book of Genesis. Jacob has spent his time with Laban. After fleeing from the wrath of his brother Esau, which was precipitated by Jacob's stealing all that would have been or could have been the firstborn Esau's. And we won't go back through all that. But his methods certainly were underhanded. Esau had a right to be upset with him. But Esau had went to the point of saying, I'm going to kill Jacob. And Jacob had fled, and he spent those years in exile there with Laban, and there he had married Rachel and Leah. And he now has a family. And it comes time for him to return, and he's returning to the land of Canaan. And of course, he kind of eases out of town unannounced to Laban, and Laban pursues him, and he's concerned about that, and he faces that challenge, and they work out their difficulties and their family situation, their squabble and all that, and Laban goes home, and Jacob and the rest proceed, but now he's got to face Esau, and Esau comes with 400 armed men, and we've covered all that ground. Esau goes home, all's well, all the challenges are behind us, all the problems are over. We can just kind of settle down, ease into life. Everything will be good. No problems on the horizon. No, no, no. They may have thought that. But there's always some problem on the horizon. There's always some temptation to face. But I don't believe they were ready for what was about to happen. In verse 17, he is at this point east of the Jordan River. He travels back north to Succoth, eventually comes over into the land of Canaan, and settles near the city of Shechem. Actually, you might say in the city, before the city, it says in verse 18. As here, unexpectedly, I think, to them, problems now arise. And the first danger that lurks, the first problem that, or the first situation that's going to bring about problems will be their proximity to the city of Shechem. They're not in a good place. Now remember, when Jacob fled from Esau, he went to Bethel. And it was Bethel where he had the vision of the angels on the stairway. He had the promises of God connected all the way back to the promises given to Abraham. And he had the promise of God to protection to bring him back to Bethel. But he's not at Bethel. He's not returned to Bethel yet. Let's go back for just a moment to Genesis chapter 12. When Abraham first came to the land of Canaan, many years before, we are told in Genesis 12:6 that he passed through the land to the place of Shechem, same place Jacob's at now. And he stayed there for a while, built an altar to the Lord and so on. But in verse 8 it says, and he moved from there to the mountain east of Bethel, and pitched his tent with Bethel on the west of Ai. Now, it doesn't really tell you the time frame, but it seems for some reason or another, Abraham sensed the problem with staying at Shechem, and he moves on to Bethel. Now, if we go back to Genesis 33, and we go over all the way into chapter 35, verse 1. Then God said to Jacob, arise and go to Bethel and dwell there and make an altar there. That's where he should have been all along. He hadn't made his way there. Somehow or another, Jacob and his family were quite satisfied to stay in probably the more populous place, the more exciting place, the more suitable place, the city of Shechem. It almost reminds you of the decision that Lot made many years before. Genesis chapter 13. When Lot's flocks became so large that they couldn't travel together with Abraham. There was conflict and such. Abraham stood back and said, Lot, you choose where you want to go. And he did what? He chose the well-watered land of the Jordan Valley. But when he goes there, he ends up pitching his tent towards Sodom. Why was Lot, the shepherd, suddenly a city dweller? I suggest he was enamored with the wrong things. For his presence in the city of Sodom devastated his family before it was all said and done, as much as Sodom itself was devastated by the judgment of God. There was, you see here now, as we move back to chapter 33, what seems to be an convenient association with an ungodly place. And how do we know that? Well, we know that more so by what is about to happen. Chapter 34, verse 1. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had born to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. When you have put yourself into an unnecessary proximity with the world, you put yourself in a dangerous place. And now Dinah, one of the daughters, ventures into Shechem, all by herself, it would seem, to see what was the case there, what they were doing there, what the daughters of the land were all doing, just hanging out in Shechem. Now, the city was called Shechem, but there's a man there by the name of Shechem, verse 2. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, now, if you go back to verse 19 of the previous chapter, the land that Jacob bought, he bought from the father of Shechem, Hamor. So, verse 2, and when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her. His soul was strongly attached to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke kindly to the young woman. But that was after the fact. Now, I'm not trying to suggest that Dinah deserved what happened to her, or that there was any thought of such a thing happening when Jacob stayed there, but there is nonetheless this unnecessary closeness, this proximity, this association, if you will, too much so, with what we as Christians today would call the world, unbelievers. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33, and this is the NIV because I think it translates it so much better. I want you to see it in the NIV. The NIV says, do not be misled. Bad company corrupts good character. I don't know that Dinah's character here was corrupted at all, or even anyone else in Jacob's household to a great extent, but I'm just pointing out that there is a consequence of a close association with unbelieving people who live their lives in a different way and with a different set of values. There's an old English proverb that goes like this: tell me the company you keep, and I'll tell you who you are. Tell me with whom you go, and I'll tell you what you do. Wow. But it's so true. I know that young people in particular in school are especially vulnerable to this thing we call peer pressure. The truth is, we're all at risk of having our character corrupted if we spend too much time the wrong individuals. Now, I'm not arguing here that Christians should be isolated from unbelievers. Jesus never isolated himself from unbelievers. He reached out to them, he befriended them, he spoke to them, he ate with them, But Jesus did not bring them into his inner circle. Even with the presence of Judas and the 12, he was not a part of the inner circle, James, John, and Peter. We need to be careful because it is our inner circle that is most important, and it should be most protected and most obviously populated with people of like faith. But what can we say here to young people or even to us as adults in regard to our associations? The book of Proverbs has a lot to say about the kind of individuals we should never bring into our closest fellowship. I've alliterated it here for you. It makes it easier to remember. You should avoid hardheads, hoodlums, hotheads, and hooked. I'm not going to read all of these verses, but you need to jot them down. Hardheads, that's people that are fools. The word fool in the Hebrew means hardened. A fool is an unbeliever. A fool is the one who says in his heart, there is no God. So unbelievers, unwise people are to be avoided for close fellowship. Proverbs 13:20 and Proverbs 14, verse 7. And then hoodlums, that's lawbreakers, people that have no regard for the law or what's right or wrong. Proverbs 12:26 and 16:19. And then we should stay away from people that have no control over their temper. I'm not saying you have to stay away from everybody that gets angry. We're going to discuss that in a minute. But those who have no control over themselves, and they quickly fly into a rage and do whatever, they're totally uncontrolled of spirit. Proverbs 22, verses 24 to 25. And then we should stay away from those that are hooked, the addicted, substance abusers that do nothing but live for that. Proverbs 23, verses 20 to 21. If we would just take those verses and that little four-point outline and commit it to heart and follow it, we wouldn't have any trouble, for the most part, with peer pressure. The problem is, especially with young people, they'll follow after someone who's popular, somebody that seems to have a presence, everybody likes them, somebody that everybody looks to and follows. God created man to worship. And if you don't worship God with all your heart, your soul, and your mind, if you don't love him in that way, you'll worship something else, or you'll worship someone else. And there's this whole concept in the world of popularity and notoriety and who's famous and who's not, and what movie star or rock star or country western singer we can go, fall down before, to some degree or another, can become false worship. Secondly, we've talked so far about unnecessary proximity to the world. They're by choice, our own choice. That's what we got to avoid. There's a second danger that we need to note that's always on the horizon is this. Unexpected provocations. Look at verse 5. And Jacob heard that he, that is Shechem, had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob held his peace until they came. In that day and age and in that culture, the sons were brought into family decisions and circumstances in a way, a much greater way than today, even in the whole process of arranging marriages for the daughters and so on. Jacob doesn't respond to this. He holds his peace, but he calls for the sons. You're going to handle this the right way. Now, it's quite possible here that Jacob is proceeding in the right manner himself. When it says he held his peace until they came, I'm assuming there came a point when he did not hold his peace. Hold that thought. Verse 6, then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him, and the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it. And the men were grieved and very angry because he had done, a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not to be done. Now, at this point, Jacob had held his peace, but then there is a meeting between he and Hamor. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that Jacob did not express himself, even his anger at that point. But the sons come in from the field. They are grieved and very angry, and rightfully so. Now remember, anger is not sinful in every case. There is such a thing as a righteous indignation. But anger, if it is not handled the right way, will turn into sinful anger very easily and very quickly. Jacob seems to handle his anger in the right way, as far as we can tell. The sons do not. It says of them in verse 7, they were very angry, very grieved. Verse 8, but Hamor spoke with them, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife. Now, remember, the sons come into this negotiation for a wife. Verse 9, and make marriages with us and give your daughters to us and take our daughters to yourselves. So you shall dwell with us and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade in it and acquire possessions for yourselves in it. Then Shechem said to her father and her brothers, let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me, I will give. Ask me ever so much dowry and gift, and I will give according to what you say to me, but give me the young woman as a wife. Now, Jacob, as far as we can tell, hasn't been deceitful. He hasn't exploded in anger. He had to have been angry. He had to have expressed it to some degree, but look what the sons do in verse 13. But the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor, his father, and spoke deceitfully. They didn't seem to express their anger, which is noted in verse 7. They simply deceive Shechem and Hamor. Because he had defiled Dinah, their sister, they spoke deceitfully. And they said to them, we cannot do this thing to give our sisters to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be approach to us. And on this condition, we will consent to you. They had no intention of consenting. Now, this is primarily Simeon and Levi here, who would have been her brothers through Leah. But on this condition, we will consent to you if you will become as we are, if every male of you is circumcised. Then we will give our daughter to you, and we will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you. They were lying. They were deceiving them. Buying themselves time to figure out how to handle this the way they really wanted to do, which was an act of vengeance. Verse 19 says, so the young man did not delay to do the thing because he delighted in Jacob's daughter, and he was more honorable than all the household of his father. And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came to the gate of the city and spoke with the men of their city, saying, these men are at peace with us. Well, they weren't, but this was what was conveyed to them. They went ahead with what was required by Simeon and Levi. Now drop down to verse 24, and all who went out of the gate of the city heeded Hamor and Shechem his son. Every male was circumcised. So who went out of the city? All who went out of the gate of his city. Now it came to pass on the third day when they were in pain, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi. Why those two? Because they were the sons of Leah, as was Dinah. Remember, you have the two wives, you have the four women because of the maids were given, and all the whole family is divided in that sense. And the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city and killed all the males. Now, I'm not sure we should understand that the two men did this. They probably had a lot of servants help. Verse 26, and they killed Hamor and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went out. The unexpected provocation should not have been maybe quite as unexpected, but for whatever reason, it came that way. They weren't prepared for it to happen. It happened. They became angered. They were provoked. And they responded sinfully. They were dishonest. They were deceitful. And then they sought and achieved vengeance for violence. Remember again, it's not anger that is sinful. We're told in Ephesians 4:26, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath. Okay, you can be angry, but it'll become sinful if it becomes vengeance. And it will become sinful all the more if you do not deal with it, but you harbor it or internalize it and let the sun go down upon your wrath. We see both of that here in this story. Remember, we're told in Romans 12, that vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. We're told to do good to those that harm us, and so on, and leave vengeance to God. But that's not what Simeon and Levi did. I wanted you to turn with me to chapter 49 of Genesis quickly. God was not obviously in approval of this, and there was a consequence. Chapter 49, Jacob's prophecy, begins with the eldest, Reuben, in verse 3, but we'll skip over him and go down to verse 5. Simeon and Levi are brothers, instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling place. Let not my soul enter their council, let not my honor be united in their assembly, for in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. There was consequences to the descendants of Simeon and Levi. And they lost the opportunity because eventually, and we haven't got to this yet in Genesis, but eventually because of sin, Reuben forfeits his rights as the eldest son. It would then fall to Simeon or Levi, and they both forfeited their rights as the elder sons. And then look what happens, chapter 49, verse 8, Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise. In your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey of my son you have gone up. Well, down in verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes. And that is universally recognized there as a promise of the Messiah's coming, and the fact that the Messiah would descend from the line of Judah, not Simeon, not Levi, not Reuben. Unexpected provocations that happen on us that we handle wrong can bring about a lot of terrible consequences. Even if you go back to chapter 34, Jacob was upset about what happened. Verse 30, and Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and I am a few in number, and they will gather themselves together against me and kill me, and I shall be destroyed, my house and all. Well, that didn't happen, but he was obviously upset. And their only answer in verse 31, but they said, should not he treat our sister like a harlot? Well, that's true. That should not have been the case. But what they did was grossly sinful as well. Let's move on to the third unexpected danger, that temptation on the horizon, unethical prosperity. I just want to touch on this briefly. Chapter 34, verse 27. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city. Now, whereas Simeon and Levi were responsible for the murders, the other sons of Jacob helped themselves to the possessions of the men of Shechem. And the sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because their sister had been defiled. And they took their sheep and their oxen and their donkeys that was in the city and what was in the field and all their wealth, all their little ones, their wives, they took captive. and they plundered even all that was in the houses. It was an opportunity to prosper at the expense of someone else. Well, they might have argued, we didn't commit the murder. No, but they certainly were accessories after the fact, were they not? They took advantage of an opportunity to prosper, created by an unethical situation or action. And in so doing, they were guilty as well. I saw here, I think it was local, where an armored car had lost some money. And I couldn't find that article, but it happens from time to time. Here's one from 2014. An armored car up in Maryland had some kind of door malfunction, and a bag of cash blew out on the highway. Suddenly, they were bringing cars to a screeching halt on the four-lane highway, and people were jumping out, scooping up $20 bills and everything. And miraculously, no one was killed, ran over. There weren't any accidents. People obviously ran off with a lot of money. The armored car people were able to recover $200, although they never said how much was in the bag. Police urged those who had picked up the cash to turn it in. One lady did. One lady turned in over $1,100. And nobody else turned in a dime, at least not when, up until that article was written. Look at these three things. You got the lust of the flesh in point one. You got the pride of life in point two. You got the lust of the eyes in point three. Connect that with what you read in Genesis 3 and what John says in 1 John chapter 2. We may look at the situation and say, well, it's just a complicated situation. How could that ever be a signpost or warning? There's principles underneath. Lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, to have what we don't own, and the pride of life, to respond to a provocation. But what, in summary, can we do? If we find ourselves in a situation that just shouts, danger, danger. When we realize we're being tempted, when we realize there is a choice to be made and we need to make the right one, what should we do? Ephesians 6:18 says we ought to be in prayer, number one. Praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit. Jesus said what? He said, our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, and so on. And let us not be tempted. Lead us not into temptation. We understand and interpret that to mean, Lord, help me to resist the temptations that come. Prayer on a regular basis. At the point in time it happens, yes, but even beforehand, and even an anticipatory type of prayer on a regular basis is important. And then we need to pray for one another. How often do you pray that some other believer or some your children or whoever it is that you know or you love, how often do you pray that they would be strong and be able to resist temptation? It's an important prayer to be praying. So prayer number one, and then secondly, watchfulness. Watchfulness. Paul says, be watchful to the end with all perseverance. You see, that young lad who was trying to pull that sneaker off, he wasn't very watchful about where he was he? And when we get so enamored with what the world has to offer us and we're doing something we shouldn't do, we're moving in that direction, we're pulling off our sneakers, we're about ready to just have a good old time, and we're unaware of the danger. We're not being watchful. Be sober, be vigilant. We read in 1 Peter 5:8. For your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, seeketh whom he may devour.